Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, as I look out upon this vast audience tonight, I am reminded that not long ago, another group of people assembled here to enjoy a stage show under the guise of glamorizing this country into a shooting war. The Fight for Freedom Committee takes a dual... The Fight for Freedom Committee takes a dual approach to their problem of making war delectable to the American people. First, the Lorelei approach, all dressed up in pink tights and spangles, and to the tune of a song in my heart, they tell the country it's fun to be free. My friends, it is fun to be free, but if we follow the method advocated by the Fight for Freedom Committee, our freedom, if it is sustained at all, will be shrouded by death and disease and heartbreak and collapse and the disillusionment and wrath of the generations to come. Approach number two, as expounded by Bishop Henry Hobson of Ohio, Chairman of the Fight for Freedom Committee, is equally fantastic. The bishop says to his co-workers, don't appeal to the intellect, appeal to the emotion. The bishop is on safe ground here because the argument that he puts forth could not possibly appeal to the intellect, even if he wanted it to. But he goes on to say that the way to get American men fighting mad is to depict American womanhood as being defiled by Hitler. I claim that American mothers, wives, and sweethearts will be a whole lot safer if our men defend their own country, their own continent, and their own hemisphere. Be a whole lot safer than if they are sent to the Caucasus, the Malay Peninsula, or Afghanistan. Now, it has taken 20 years of hard fact-finding for us to know what hit us before we finally decided to get into the last war. The America First Committee has made an honest and competent attempt to keep the facts of the present buildup for war before the American people, as we have been going along. What the America First Committee has collected as evidence will loom large on the pages of history. We have conducted, if you please, a parallel investigation of the facts, step by step, appealing to the intellect and not to the emotions of the American people. In this effort, one man stands out as the ace fact finder. He is beloved in New York as a gentleman and a scholar, admired and respected in Washington and the rest of the country. When he comes to Washington, he comes bearing knowledge, evidence, facts, and not grease paint, ballet slippers, a tightrope, or a trapeze. It is now my very great pleasure to introduce the permanent chairman of the evening, the chairman of the New York chapter of the America First Committee, Mr. John T. Flynn.
Mrs. Clark, distinguished guests, When, ladies and gentlemen, I welcome you here tonight once more in a great critical hour of our country's life. I regret very deeply that I cannot extend a welcome to those many millions all over this land who are eager to hear what is being said here tonight, but who cannot do so because three or four men who control the radio networks of this country have arbitrarily shut off from the air the voice of this great meeting. Now, my friends, when you hear something that you agree with, won't you please applaud? And when you hear something that you do not agree with, don't bother about the booze. Two of the radio networks have declared that they have offered us time. They have said also that they have given to the anti-war groups as much time on the air as they have allowed to the war-making groups in this debate. Tonight, my friends, I want to take just a minute or two to tell you the facts about these preposterous claims. There are three national network corporations: the National Broadcasting Company, the Columbia, and the Mutual. They operate four great chains. From the beginning, these chains have pretended that they would give to the anti-war speakers as much time as they would extend to the interventionists. If a speaker representing one of the war committees got 15 minutes on the air, the radio companies would give 15 minutes to us. And so they claim that the time which has been enjoyed by speakers on the other side has been balanced completely by the time which our speakers have had. But these claims are pure and unadulterated subterfuge. They leave out completely a whole range of speakers and programs. They leave out completely all count of the newscasters, so-called, the commentators, the radio dramas, the government programs and spots, and the visiting war hawks from all over the globe. They leave out the programs of all sorts of those who are bundling for Britain and for every other country under the sun save America, under the guise of collecting relief for Britain, or Greece, or Russia, or China, or a dozen other countries. These programs are explosive with propaganda for war, for getting us in on the side of these various countries. They leave out such programs as that fake Irish Defense Committee, which, while pretending to be an American committee, was inspired, organized, and sponsored by British agents in this country and can get plenty of time on the air. Then there are the programs for selling defense bonds and collecting aluminum. There's no objection to a radio appeal to the people to buy defense bonds, but these little programs are almost always hooked up with appeals to hatred and fear, putting emphasis on all those shoddy terrors about Hitler coming here and saving democracy and defending America from the Nazis, which are the stock in trade of the war propagandists. Now, if you will count on our side all of our speakers against war and whatever commentators and other programs you can find, and on the other side, all the formal speakers for intervention, plus the army of commentators and government and other interventionist programs, I tell you that for every hour we have had on the air, the other side has had 20. And I am prepared to prove this. From time to time, I have had the air carefully monitored or watched. Let me give you some figures about three successive days, not very long ago. Now, in these figures on our side, I count every program which speaks out against war, whether they were on the air for America First or some other sustained or sponsored program wholly unconnected with us. On the other side, I make a similar count. I include not only the senators and the other war committee speakers, but the Kaltenborns and the Winchells and the Vandercooks and the Raymond Graham Swings and the William Shirers and the Raymond Clappers and the Eleanor Roosevelts and the Dorothy Thompsons and all of the other male and female angels of war, and also all the Broadway and Hollywood sketches and government programs devoted to interventionist propaganda. Some of these commentators, by the way, are on once a week, some of them two or three times a week, and some of them every day. Now, as a matter of fact, there is hardly any need to prove this to the people of America. You who have ears to hear and radio sets in your home know this story. But let me give you the figures. On the 3 days which I take these figures from, and for which I had the air checked from 8 in the morning until 12 at midnight, 16 hours a day for 3 days, 48 hours in all, continuously. And here is the record of the interventionist speeches and programs, direct or indirect, which appeared in those 3 days. On Columbia's WABC, there were 21 interventionist broadcasts. On Mutual's WOR, there were 28. On the National Broadcasting Company's WEF, there were 33. On the National Broadcasting Company's WJZ, there were 45. Observe that on the National Broadcasting Company's two stations, WEF and WJZ, in 3 days there were a total of 78 interventionist programs. All of these four major networks, on all of them together, there was a total of 127 broadcasts in 3 days devoted to interventionist propaganda. That is 127 broadcasts in 48 hours, or almost three every hour. And this does not count all the programs that appeared on the innumerable minor stations serving this and other cities. And now here is the vital fact. There were 127 interventionist fear and scare programs in 3 days on 4 stations. And how many do you think were allowed on those same stations on our side in that same time? Just 6. Yet the president of one of these chains, in a spirit of aggrieved righteousness, has the brass to tell the public through the newspapers that we have gotten as much time as the other side. He knows that is not so. And the American people know it is not so. And I add this further comment before I am through with this, because this has been a matter of public discussion in the last few days, that if this country gets into this war, and millions of American boys perish in this war, the darkest stain of that blood guilt amongst all the lawmakers will be on the hands of the owners and controllers of these radio chains. Now, just one sentence or two on this point. At the last moment today, in response to repeated pleas and demands for radio time, finally, one of the radio chains the Mutual Broadcasting Company, WOR, decided to make a phonographic transcription of this meeting and to broadcast from 11:30 to 12 o'clock tonight one half hour of what goes on here. Now, my friends, so much for that. We're here for one purpose. We are here to make a last stand against those many minority forces which have combined to drag this nation into war. One year ago today, the President of the United States made his famous pledge that he would never take our boys into foreign wars. Now he has practically... Now he has practically told you that he's already taken us into war. But he's not so sure of this. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please, 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 ladies and gentlemen, I want to call your attention to one thing which I think you will agree with me is important. Now, please listen to me intently and attentively on this. Hecklers get into meetings and try to break them up. Now, they cannot break them up without your help. This is a vast audience, and we who are speaking to you have the advantage of a microphone. The man who heckles and makes outcries is a lone person, and in this great crowd is lost unless you decide to pay attention to him instead of paying attention to the speaker. Now, when you hear these interruptions, do not pay any attention to them. Do not turn around to see where they are coming from. Ignore them, and you will find that they will soon die out. Listen to the speakers. Now, I say the president is not so sure, however, that he's got this into war, so he is asking the Congress of the United States to pass another law. What he wants is a declaration of war, but he knows that he cannot get that from the representatives of the American people. So he is calling for war, but he is giving it another name. He calls it repeal of the Neutrality Act. He wants to start an all-out war in the Atlantic, the Battle of the Atlantic, as he calls it. But he refuses to speak out to you the whole truth. He refuses to use the word war. He hopes that if the neutrality law is repealed, the shooting will get underway quickly, and that then he can come before the Congress and say that a state of war actually exists and ask them to recognize it as a fact. We are here in the name of our homes, in the name of our young sons, in the name of the fathers of this republic who gave us this great inheritance of freedom, in the name of the future of mankind itself, in the name of our own freedom and democracy, to lift up our voices against this infamy. We have here three distinguished American citizens, patriots, who will state tonight the people's case against this war. And my business now is to present them to you. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing rare about the courage of men who face death on the battlefield. Millions do it every day in Europe. Millions have died uncomplaining. But there is a kind of courage that is rare indeed. It is the courage of the man who, against the interests and demands of his party, against the frowns and even the contumely of his friends, dares to stand up and tell the truth. Last week in Washington, at the secret sessions of the Foreign Relations Committee of the Senate, I listened for 4 hours to a magnificent presentation of the case of America, of your case, against the repeal of the Neutrality Act. That presentation was made by a truly brave man who is here tonight. He too can say, I have seen war. I hate war. He was in Belgium when the cruel war machine of Hitler rolled over that little country. He could tell you what that war is. He's here now to lift his voice against it. And I have the honor to present to you our former ambassador, minister to Ireland, our former ambassador to Poland and to Belgium, Mr. John Cudahy of Wisconsin.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished guests, and you, my fellow Americans, I can tell you it's inspiring to stand here and look over this great sea of faces inspired by only one motive, and that is the welfare of their country. In these times of pro this and anti that, and this ism and that ism, here in this group, there is only one ism, and that is Americanism. I am not a member of this organization which has organized this magnificent meeting. I come to you simply as an individual. I do not belong to any organization concerned with our foreign policy. But I come here and I speak to you in the same spirit that I would testify in a court of law when holding my hand on high, I took an oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. For 8 years, I served as your representative in some of the leading capitals of Europe. And from one end of that distracted continent to the other, I went trying to determine the causes which brought about this war. And I say to you, with all the fervor of my soul, that this war is a war of Europe. And not a war of America. We did not start it. We had nothing to do with the causes which brought it about. Let us stay out of it. In Belgium, only about a year and a half ago, I saw the mighty Nazi machine roll over that poor, peaceful little country. And I saw it lying prostrate and bleeding in the murderous wake of that terrible war machine. And after that, France fell, and Norway. But all of these facts were before the American people. All of them were presented in the last campaign, and both candidates pledged peace. And the issue of the campaign was one of the greatest issues, was to keep us out of that war of Europe. It's only a year ago tonight that the president of this country stood before the people, and I can hear his voice now as it came over this black magic that we call the radio. It was soft and low as a lullaby, and it pledged to you people that none of your sons would be sent to foreign wars. Now, you know, and I know, and everyone in this great audience knows, that if one of the candidates for the presidency had even intimated that there was a possibility of getting us into that war of Europe, they would have been defeated. And who would have been sent to the White House? All of these facts were before the candidates. They were before the American people, and the decision was made to keep us out of the war of Europe. Now, what has changed? What has changed? England was fighting for his life in her heroic defense 1 year ago. Nothing has changed in Europe, but much has changed in this country. And you have seen the foreign policy of the nation moving step by step to the precipice of war. And they have been so consistent in their inconsistency. They passed a neutrality law. It was given a great deal of study. Its aim was to keep us out of the war. And now, they seek to repeal the neutrality law to keep us out of war and preserve the peace. I tell you, my friend, there is one great hope, and that is, at this time, at the conclusion of this phase of the Russian campaign, to advance a plan for peace. Three weeks ago, in a debate with Professor McGovern of Northwestern University, I made the proposal that the President of the United States, with the consent of Congress, issue a call to all the nations of the world to assemble at a peace table. Since then, there have been a great number of editorial comments, abusive, and some of them ridicule, and even in scurrilous terms. And while I have been called a warmonger, it's a new one to me, since this proposal, I've been called a peacemonger. So you see before you a peacemonger. I'm glad there are so many of us. And I want to tell you that our numbers are growing stronger each year, each day, among the real people of this country. They say it's useless to propose peace because you cannot have any peace with Hitler. I want to tell you that Hitler, although most people seem to think so, is not immortal. When I saw him and interviewed him as a correspondent just 5 months ago, he looked like a very sick man. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if his days were numbered. But Hitler is only a passing phase in this tragic world picture. Back of Hitler, the real force of Germany today is the army, the generals of the general staff. And the people of Germany never had any stomach for this war at the beginning. They yearn for peace. But they fear a peace of vengeance. They fear a peace like the peace of Versailles and all the woes that have ever descended upon Germany since the last war, the great poverty, the inflation that wiped out the savings of a lifetime overnight, the degradation, the humiliation, the vast unemployment of 7 million, all these woes are ascribed to the Treaty of Versailles. Now, the people of Germany fear another peace that will be even more vengeful and more humiliating, more degrading than the peace of Versailles. And I put it to you as common sense people. If you were German, I ask you, what hope is presented to you by the war aims of the British or the Atlantic Charter? I am not so much interested in Hitler. He is only a symptom or a phenomenon. I am interested in the malignant causes that produced the Hitler. This tragic chapter of the world's history, this black episode that we are witnessing, commenced directly as a result of the last war. It began in Russia. That terrible despotism, but it is even more revolting than the despotism of Germany. I know I have been in both places. I want to tell you it's a depressing experience. But it was the poverty. It was this vast impoverishment of the world from the waste of war that produced a Stalin, a Lenin, a Mussolini, and a Hitler. We have in this country one of the greatest experts on European affairs, a great patriot, a man who is ready and eager to serve his country, the former President of the United States, Herbert Hoover. Mr. Hoover to work. Put him to work on a peace plan. To determine the causes that produced this war. And you would not believe what a ready ear the German people would give to such a plan at this time. They say, no peace with Hitler, but back of Hitler, even with his absolute power, are the German people and the German generals. And Hitler would not dare resist an invitation to attend a peace conference at this time. We have a vast potentiality for war, and we can use that vast potentiality as a threat at the peace table to compel the warring powers to sit at a conference. Now we have in this country 85% of the world's gold. All economists are puzzling their brains as to what to do with it. And no one has yet found any solution. Let us take this gold, bring it to this peace meeting, and offer it as a basis for the reestablishment of the gold standard. Far back of these hatreds and animosities that have engendered this war are the economic causes, the trade barriers and restrictions that have reduced nations to penury and which have brought about a marching of the armies. Those of the war party may sneer as they choose, but the time has come when the choice must be made between peace and war. This has been a war of nerves, and a nation cannot exist half peace and half war. Now down in Washington, some of these colleagues of Senator Nye and Senator Wheeler seem to think that they can make war by oratory and by just deciding that we'll go to war and end it. And that'll decide it, because we're going to enter the war. It's all over. I want to tell you now, I have seen the mighty German war machine. I saw it roll through Belgium, an endless stream of might, day and night, rolling through the main streets and on the way to France. And it produced an impression on me I shall remember as long as I live. Now, what I think doesn't count very much as a military expert, although we're developing military experts all over this nation. Governor Lehman has become an expert on the defense of, and my friend Senator Pepper, that some of you now. I always thought that if you had anything wrong with you, a disease of any kind, you went to a doctor. And if you had a question of a lawsuit, you went to a lawyer. And there are men that are far more able than you and I, or any of us, who have spent all the years of their lives studying this profession called military science. And those men, without a single exception, have told us that this great bugaboo, this great scare of an invasion of this country is absolutely ridiculous. And there isn't a single exception. I know what war means. And I know that if we enter this war, we can't do it by oratory, and we can't do it by going just that far. We've got to assemble and marshal the might of this country. And if we enter the war, we've got to win the war. And the men who know, the military experts, not alone of this country, but of Great Britain, say that the only way that Germany can be beaten is by an invasion of that country. And that means an expeditionary force of 9 million men. In the last war, we entered when Germany was exhausted. At the end of 3 long years. And it called, we sent to France 2 million. 2 million men in that expeditionary force. And it cost us in killed and maimed and wounded 160,000. I ask you, what will be the casualties in this next war? That is the alternative. They would take us along the road of war. And when we say war, there is no such thing as limited war. We have protested against this war madness, and our protests have been ignored. We have petitioned, and they have scorned our petitions. We have pleaded, and our words have been unavailing as the wind. Now, we plead no more. We petition no more. We waste no further words. We defy them. Defy them. To lead this nation into war by minority rule. Back of us are the plain people of this country. Who have never been given a hearing on this issue. It is for them that we speak. For the fathers who have sweat and toiled and sacrificed to give their sons an education and give them a fuller life which is to them denied. To the mothers whose tears of anguish will flow in a mighty river across this land. And to the youth whose blood will drench red the battlefields of Europe. Back of us are assembling the inarticulate masses of this nation, and we are growing stronger every day. And we will go on and on with no stop, no halt, until we do get a hearing. For this nation, for peace, and for America.
Ladies and gentlemen, I need not introduce to you your next speaker. That brave spirit whose voice has filled this whole land with the sheer eloquence of truth since this battle began. I present to you once again, Charles A. Lindbergh.
At regular intervals in the life of a man or of an organization, there is much to be gained by resurveying policies and convictions in the ever-growing light of experience. A great deal has taken place since this war began in the fall of 1939. Every man, every organization, in fact, every nation has the privilege of judging its ideas and ideals from the vantage point of 2 years of wartime history. During the past several weeks, I have attempted to do this for myself, and I believe that every one of you would find the time well spent to do the same. In this period of war and revolution, of conflicting emotions and beliefs, every man should use the facts of the past to reorient his mind for his attitude and his action in the future. It is no more than right, I believe, that those of us who have taken a leading part in opposing American intervention should be willing to lay our motives openly before the millions of Americans who have stood at our side. Tonight, therefore, I am going to ask you to come with me in your minds back to the years immediately preceding this war. Your reasons for opposing intervention may not be identical with mine, but those of us who do oppose it can work more effectively if we understand and respect each other's motives. Life would be dull indeed if every man agreed in detail, but there would be no civilized life at all if we were unable to submerge our detailed differences in the strength of a common cause. I was living and traveling in Europe during most of the 4 years that preceded the declaration of war. I lived for 2 years in England and for 1 year in France, and I traveled through most of the other countries over there. I think you will understand when I say that from the first time I landed at Paris in 1927, From that time on, France had become for me a second home. I was, and I still am, deeply interested in her welfare and in the welfare of Europe as a whole. That interest is second only to the welfare of my own country. In fact, my opposition to this war first arose because of my concern about the effect it would have on Europe. It was not until a later date that I fully understood the danger a European war involved for America. My realization of the dangers and problems that lay ahead came with a trip I made to Germany in 1936. There is not time for me to describe tonight all I saw in that country, or to contrast the conditions in pre-war Germany with the conditions in England and France. But it was clear to me at that time that Germany had, or would soon have, by far the strongest army and air force in the world, and that she intended to use her military forces to increase her influence and expand her territory. Probably even more significant than the size of her army and her air force was the fact that the people of Germany were ready for war, while the people of France and England were not. My estimate of the situation in Europe and the best policy to follow was different than that of most of my friends. After the Siegfried Line was built, I knew that the French and British armies were no longer in a position to attack Germany successfully. I knew that the German Air Force was stronger than any combination that could be brought against it, and that England was in a disadvantageous position from the standpoint of air power. Hitler had weapons which Napoleon had lacked. He had aviation with which to strike at England and the British Navy, and he had modern communication and mechanized transport with which to overcome the great distances of Russia. It seemed obvious to me that these weapons changed the military balance and strategy not only of Europe, but of the entire world. By 1938, I had come to the conclusion that if a war occurred between Germany on the one side and England and France on the other, it would result either in a German victory or in a prostrate and devastated Europe. I therefore advocated that England and France build their military forces with the utmost rapidity, but that they permit Germany to expand eastward into Russia without declaring war. As you know, the opposite school of thought prevailed. The men who were in control in England and France said that Germany was bluffing, that she was not strong enough to win a major war, that air power was no match for the British Navy, and that the best way for England and France to defend themselves was to defend Poland. The idealists rushed forward with the cry that aggression must be stopped and that war must be declared on Germany in order to preserve the peace and civilization of Europe. In most cases, the people who cried the loudest for war knew nothing about the military situation and were not those who had to do the fighting. But they made the same promises and the same claims to Frenchmen and to Englishmen that are being made to Americans today. Now, after 2 years of war, we are in a better position to judge the policies that were followed by England and France. We are in a better position to judge who was right and who was wrong. Those who said a navy was more than a match for air power were wrong. Those who promised aid to Poland if she fought misled her as they misled every other country that took their side. The idealists who shouted so glibly for war sent thousands of the finest men of France and England to defeat and death. They now find themselves allied with Soviet Russia, and they have seen European civilization collapsing with every day of war. Hardly a promise that was made to the peoples of France and England when this war began has survived the test of 2 years of struggle. Most of these promises were made by well-meaning and honest men, but by men who were too far separated from life and fact. They erred, but it was not they who paid the price for their error. That price was paid in the blood and suffering and despair of European people. In view of what has taken place in these last 2 years, I believe that those of us who opposed a declaration of war by England and France have been justified in our stand. If Germany had been permitted to throw her armies eastward into Russia in 1939 instead of in 1941, the picture in Europe would be far different today. Whether or not Germany would have turned west after conquering Russia is debatable. But even if she had done so, a weaker Germany would have faced a stronger England and France. Now I have told you why I opposed war in the years before it was declared in Europe. Let me lay before you the motives I had for opposing intervention by America. When hostilities commenced in Europe, I knew that every effort would be made to involve the United States. I believed that our intervention would be disastrous both for America and for Europe. I felt it would be disastrous for America because we were unprepared for war and because we had problems enough of our own. Problems which it would be... problems which it would be sufficiently difficult to solve without the added complication of a major war. I felt our intervention would be disastrous for Europe because it seemed obvious to me that European nations must eventually adjust their affairs among themselves. I knew that no amount of intervention by the United States could change the basic fact that aviation weakens the military position of the British Isles in relation to the continent. I believed that the future of England and France depended more upon their own birth rates and internal conditions than upon our assistance in winning another war. Our participation in the last war showed how futile it is for America to attempt to solve the problems of Europe. Englishmen themselves have said that Europe would be better off today if we had not entered the last war, because in that case, a peace would have been made that would have been more practical and lasting. My opposition to American intervention was based upon many reasons, but I think that none was stronger than my belief that modern aviation made it impractical, if not impossible, for an expeditionary force to cross an ocean and land successfully on a hostile coast against strong enemy air power. I believed that history and experience and judgment all showed that the destiny of America should not be tied to the outcome of European war. From that time on, in articles and radio addresses, I have advocated that we make America so strong that no foreign powers will ever attempt to attack us. But that we leave European wars to European nations. As you all know, in spite of the opposition of the American people, we have been led step by step to war until today we are actually engaged in undeclared naval warfare. How this was accomplished is one of the most amazing and alarming developments in the history of the United States. Those of us who have stood out against war have from the beginning encountered an insidious opposition. It has been an opposition whose word has not been good from one side of an election to another. It has been an opposition that has made constant use of undercover methods, an opposition that has fought in personalities and smearing campaigns and not on issues. An opposition that has discarded one American tradition after another, while it claims to be upholding the American way of life. If the issue of intervention had been placed openly before our Congress and our people, a decision could have been reached in the traditional American way. But this was not done because the interventionists knew that the American people would not agree to war. Instead of submitting the issue of war to our vote, they said, "Of course we will not go to war, but couldn't we aid England and France just by selling them arms if they send their own ships and pay us in cash?" We agreed to what seemed to most Americans a harmless and reasonable request and repealed our embargo on arms. But that was just the first step in a carefully laid out road to war. These steps to war were taken in a way that was cunningly calculated to disarm opposition. They were taken under cover of false promises and implications. Our president ran for re-election on a party platform that was against war. He promised us again and again and again that American boys would not be sent abroad to fight. But at the very moment these promises were being made, preparations for foreign war went on in the name of American defense. When our citizens were called upon to submit to the draft, they were told that it would be for only 1 year, although the administration was well aware that a year would be insufficient for adequate training. When we were asked to support the Lease-Lend bill, we were told that it was the best way to keep this country out of war. When President Roosevelt ordered the occupation of Iceland without asking the consent of Congress, we were told that it was for American defense and that American troops would replace the British who were then in occupation. Later, we find that our occupation of Iceland is to protect the British supply lines and that we continue to occupy it jointly with their forces. One month, President Roosevelt tells us that the American Navy will see to it that England receives the arms necessary to defeat Germany. And the next month, he tells us that our battleships, patrolling these arms through the German war zone, have been attacked without provocation. President Roosevelt and his administration have never taken the American people into their confidence. They preach about preserving democracy and freedom abroad while they practice dictatorship and subterfuge at home. They used the phrase, aid to the Allies, to involve us in foreign war. They use the phrase American defense to prepare us for foreign war. They use the phrase stepped short of war to lead us to foreign war. In place of our traditional American idea of a government run by the people, President Roosevelt has substituted the new concept of a people run by the government. Men and women of New York, we must face the fact that our nation is on the verge of war today. Up to the present moment, the interventionists in America have been successful in leading on to war, as were their brethren in England and France. The interventionists have a unique and ominous record. They have won practically every argument they have made at home and lost practically every battle they have fought abroad. But for America, the final step into war has not yet been taken. Our Congress has not authorized a declaration of war, and national polls show that our people are overwhelmingly opposed to it. If we still had in fact, as well as in name, a representative government, we would be far from war today. The imminent danger of war lies in the action taken by President Roosevelt and his supporters. Without asking the consent of Congress, they placed our Navy in a position where American warships were certain to be attacked. With the utmost cleverness, they maneuvered us into the German war zone in the name of defense, and then claimed that we were the victim of unprovoked attack. Before we allow ourselves to be committed finally and irrevocably to war, let us do what France and England failed to do. Let us, for a moment, put our emotions and desires in the background and look clearly and objectively at the type of war that confronts us. Let us estimate the cost and the chances of success, and then make our decision calmly and intelligently in a traditional American way. We are a nation of mixed races, of mixed religions, of mixed creeds. In the space of a few generations, this country has changed from a wilderness to the greatest industrial nation on earth. Never in the history of man has the environment of human life changed as rapidly as it has right here in America. With this mixture of ideologies, with this new environment of life, we are struggling to build a new civilization in a new world. Surrounded by burning problems of economic and social adjustment, we are trying to create here in America the type of civilization of which our forefathers dreamed. A civilization that turns to a higher purpose, the energy that Europe has always wasted upon war. Has ever a nation been confronted with more difficult problems or with higher ideals? Shall we inject into this picture the chaos and confusion of the greatest war the world has ever experienced? After all these generations of American independence for which we fought? Are we now to submerge our future in the endless wars of the old world? Is this the great American ideal toward which we have been striving all these years? Let us consider the military picture. We are on the verge of a war that would require us to attack the strongest military power the world has ever known. A war that would probably force us to fight in both the Atlantic and Pacific, in both Europe and Asia at the same time. To be successful, we would have to transport mechanized armies of millions of men across the ocean and land them on hostile coasts defended by the best and most hardened armies of the Eastern Hemisphere. In the case of Europe, we would have to land on a coast which the French and British and Belgian armies combined were unable to hold even with the assistance of long-established fortifications. If we should be successful in such an enterprise, it would involve the death and maiming of millions of American soldiers. Every family in this nation would have its wounded and its dead. I say if we should be successful, but before we could carry on war on such a scale, we would have to turn this country into a military nation that would surpass Germany herself in totalitarian efficiency. We would have to train and equip an army of not less than 10 million men, and we would have to build a navy and a merchant marine that could transport such an army across the ocean. And then we would be confronted with the problem that England has been unable to solve. How can an expeditionary force be landed on an enemy coast defended by strong air power? Britain's navy was unable to support her army in Norway or in Flanders or in Greece. Britain was not able to invade the continent even while the German army was occupied in Russia. And Britain has only 25 miles to go in comparison to our more than 2,500. This war we are asked to enter would be the greatest and most devastating conflict in all history. And what have we to gain from either a material or an ideal standpoint? Do you think our American way of life will survive long years of a totalitarian system? Do you believe that civilized ideals can spring from death and disease and starvation all over the world? Suppose we were able to win such a war, would we still have the strength and desire to police the world with our armies in order to prevent a similar war in another generation? If we look forward to policing the world after this war is over, then we will almost certainly have to remain a totalitarian state in order to maintain the military efficiency for such a prodigious undertaking. If we do not intend to police the world, then what happened after the last war is an excellent indication of what is likely to happen again after the next. Men and women of New York, the future of this nation and of our American ideals is in jeopardy today as never before in our history. It seems clear to me that it would be disastrous for us to enter this war abroad. But there is one thing that would be even more disastrous to our nation, and that is a continuation of the subterfuge, the confusion, and the irresponsibility with which we have been led along the road to war. The most fundamental issue today is not one of war or peace, but one of integrity. Whether we go to war or whether we stay out. We have the right to demand integrity in the leadership of this nation. Whether we are for intervention or whether we are opposed to it, we can unite in believing that if we have integrity in our leadership and confidence in that integrity, this nation of ours is great enough to survive either in adversity or success. If we have confidence in that integrity, we will pass through these years ahead, whether they be years of peace or years of war, and emerge a stronger nation than we were when they began. As Americans, we never have, and as Americans, we never will fear any foreign enemy. There is no danger to this nation from without. Our only danger lies from within. I appeal to all Americans, no matter what their viewpoint on the war may be, to unite behind the demand for a leadership in Washington that stands squarely upon American traditions. To unite behind the demand for a leadership of integrity instead of subterfuge, of openness instead of secrecy, a leadership that demonstrates its Americanism by taking the American people into its confidence. I thank you.